Popular Front presents Skeleton Key, a monthly report on contemporary far-right militancy all over the world. Only at patreon.com/popularfront. In this episode, we're speaking to anti-fascist researcher Andy Fleming. He's going to give us a breakdown on the history of far-right activity in Australia and the current rise of neo-Nazism and their connections to international white supremacy movements. So I think before we go into the more contemporary situation with the far right in Australia, maybe you can give us a kind of brief history of the fascist movements over there. I think it's a bit of a blind spot for a lot of researchers, even in the anti-fascist scenes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, you can go back a century, really, to the 1920s when Italian fascists were active in Australia. And naturally, that engendered a response, especially among Italian migrants. So the first anti-fascist groups in Melbourne, where I'm speaking from, were formed in the 1920s. And, of course, Italians, Spanish, Germans, there are a whole range of migrant communities that battled against the fascist presence in their, you know, local communities. But I suppose the other thing about Australia is, you know, it was, I think, in the 1920s, 1930s that Mosley commented that he was impressed by Australia because it had developed spontaneously, from his perspective, a fascist movement of its own that didn't name itself as such. And he was thinking in particular about the White Australia policy. So in terms of the development of the far right and fascism in Australia, it's really important to recognise that for most of its history, certainly since colonisation, but also the actual formal assembly of the state in 1901, it was explicitly committed to a White Australia policy, so a whites-only country, which colonised a lot of the political space that fascist movements, especially those based on, you know, white racialism, Aryan supremacy, something of that sort. That territory had already been colonised in a sense by the mainstream. So it was really only post-Second World War, when there began to be major changes in the relationship of the state to you know, the Crown and also US politics. And also following the Second World War, there were a whole lot of Nazis that came to Australia as part of the migration program. So, you know, that's the broader history. More recently, you can kind of look at the far right and fascism as emerging in response to the abandonment of the White Australia policy and the embrace of something called multiculturalism. So, rather than state policy being based on the assimilation of immigrant communities, something called multiculturalism was developed to replace this kind of white supremacy. And it triggered a response. There are many who reject what's called multiculturalism. They remain. Very often it's either explicitly or implicitly about a celebration of white nationalism. Australia is a white country, you know, so contemporary fascists will, you know, some will explicitly say we're white racialists, others will just say we're Australian. That's the kind of background to most of the contemporary fascist and far-right movements and groups.
So it kind of, the fascism really started with the government, essentially, in Australia. It wasn't like necessarily militant groups or, you know, volunteers forming at the start. It was just very much focused from the state.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, I mean, there were fascist groups in the 20s and 30s, but they were minority. They never really commanded mass support. And they were groups like the New Guard and the Old Guard. There was a whole range of different groups that either drew from inspiration from fascist Italy or Nazi Germany or even British imperialism. But insofar as it was informed by a commitment to, say, white nationalism, that was already accepted across the political spectrum. So in a sense, there was nothing really to fight for. Anti-Semitism was a theme, but again, it was not a major theme. And in any case, there was never really any major fascist movement that developed in Australia independently of the state. And that's, you know, some have argued that's because the state kind of imposed its own form of racial rule.
Right. It's like if you've got a fascist state, you don't then need to form little groups to battle them because they're essentially speaking your language.
Pretty much. Yeah, I mean, the White Australia policy wasn't abandoned until the 1960s.
Oh, crazy. So when that was abandoned, what happened then? I imagine that's when there were factions starting to build up. I understand a lot of people were very unhappy about it.
There were some. I mean, it was also in response to demands for labour. So, you know, the state needed labour to develop the country. It's a stolen country, by the way, obviously. But the kind of migrant communities that were available at the end of the Second World War, the Australian authorities had to expand it beyond Northern and Western Europe. So began to get a much larger number of Greeks and, you know, Greeks and Italians began to migrate in larger numbers. Also people from Eastern Europe, and that required flexibility on the part of the state in terms of, you know, who qualified as white. And eventually by the 1970s, both because of the, you know, expanded migration program and changes, general changes to Australian society that became more, in a sense, liberal, less racially, explicitly racially discriminatory, multiculturalism developed. And there was a backlash. So it was in the late 70s, early 80s, you began to see the development of groups like Australians Against Further Immigration, or the Australian League of Rights, which had been around since the 1940s, explicitly anti-Semitic and white nationalist. It began to gain a kind of broader audience. And so these kinds of sentiments, these racist sentiments, were given license by those who were critics of multiculturalism, because multiculturalism was understood as being, you know, allowing, and by culture really was meant nation, race, ethnicity. You know, obviously there's lots of different cultures, different ways of living, but in the Australian context of the 1970s, this was almost invariably in response to, you know, relatively large numbers of Greek and Italian migrants. And also in the 70s, Vietnamese refugees began to arrive in the country. Australia had joined the United States in a war against Vietnam. And so there are arguments about, well, what do you do with these people who are fleeing war and oppression and coming to Australia? That was the first kind of, you know, boat people crisis. And there's been several since. They're mostly manufactured, mostly in order to kind of promote this kind of idea of Fortress Australia, which has a long history. Anti-Asian racism has played a major factor in most of Australian political history. All these things began to grow again in the 70s and 80s, especially in the 80s when Hawke Keating, you know, they introduced neoliberalism. You know, in the UK it was Thatcher, in the US it was Reagan, in Australia it was the Labour Party.
So in terms of the more militant groups, when did that all start?
You had Nazi groups of one sort or another from the 30s. A number were interned during the Second World War for obvious reasons. They had a difficult time re-establishing themselves in the 50s and 60s. In the 60s, you began to see, you know, very small groups. The National Socialist Party of Australia, which, you know, obviously had its split in the Australian National Socialist Party of Australia. You know, the usual kind of stuff that you'll find on the far right across, you know, the Western, you know, world or the English-speaking world. But then in the late 70s, early 80s, you saw kind of coalition around issues to do with immigration and race. So you saw the emergence of National Action. That was a key group. It also drew inspiration from so-called skinhead culture in the UK, you know, boneheads, that had begun to have an impact in the late 70s, early 80s. They were the kind of street level kind of thugs. National Action, you know, it did not call itself neo-Nazi. It didn't embrace Hitler. It was all about Australian white nationalism. So, you know, it flew the Eureka flag, a symbol of Australian nationalism. It drew on anti-Chinese sentiment on the goldfields in the 1800s. It tried to kind of distance itself from explicit anti-Semitism and anything to do with Nazi Germany, with, you know, varying degrees of success, because many of the people who were drawn to it were, you know, had their own love of Hitler. There was a split in that movement between National Action and another group called the Australian Nationalist Movement. That was headed by a guy called Jack Van Tongeren. Interesting character. He was a veteran of the war on Vietnam. He was of mixed racial descent. you know, he was termed, he was given the nickname Java Jack within the movement because his father was from Java in, you know, contemporary Indonesia. So, but he was kind of, he took a much more explicit neo-Nazi approach, and they engaged in various, you know, activities that would be called terrorism. They may or may not have been at the time. He ended up in prison for quite a period of time. Probably the most violent, murderous violence was associated with the A&M. National Action had more kind of street level presence, and it engaged in various forms of, you know, harassment of activists and, you know, outspoken anti-racists. And in 1989, there was an inquiry instituted into racist violence, partly inspired by the actions of National Action and the terrorism of the A&M in Perth, which, has been the subject of a great documentary, Nazi Supergrass, which looks at how the group kind of imploded under pressure from the state and from others. That was the last kind of spectacular violence. There was a, you know, an arson campaign that was conducted in Perth in the late 80s, intended to drive Asian migrants and especially Chinese migrants from the city. It had some kind of an effect. And the interesting thing about the group was that although it was only certain kinds of actions were, you know, confirmed later as having been the responsibility of the group, it triggered a lot of copycat actions. So it kind of gave license to racist individuals engaged in direct action against Chinese restaurants and other institutions. So it kind of demonstrated how whenever these kinds of ideas and groups are given any kind of license or are seen to, it can trigger much more popular kinds of racist violence.
Mm. I think we should talk as well about the Aborigine situation, because it's something that really kind of blows my mind. Like, even to this day, like, I've never been to Australia, but I had a friend live out there and he was working with the Aborigines and he was in places where they were living, and he was saying, like, even to this day, they're just treated so badly. I mean, it's their land. Like, you know what I mean? Maybe we should talk about that, because I imagine that kind of contributes to a bit of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's foundational. You know, it's a colonial settler society. There's never been a treaty between the state and Indigenous peoples. Sovereignty has never been ceded. It's an ongoing issue. It's an ongoing process, that is colonisation. And, you know, if you look at Australian history, it was only in, I think, 1992 that there was a famous court case referred to as the Mabo case, in which an Indigenous man from the north of so-called Australia brought a case to the High Court and said, this is my land, that the Crown has no legitimate claim to it. And what it established was that the basis for British occupation was terra nullius. This was a land without people. Therefore, there was no obligation on the part of the Crown to enter into any kind of legal or other, you know, political process to establish any kind of, you know, legitimacy for the Crown. So that was 30 years ago. Since then, there's been all kinds of attempts to legal and political to address the issue. They haven't been. Indigenous peoples remain dispossessed. Their rights are not acknowledged under law, international law or Australian domestic law. It's an ongoing tragedy, crisis, call it what you will, an ongoing reality which is still being grappled with. And that forms the kind of basis for all other articulations of politics, whether it's, you know, especially to do with race and claims of political legitimacy. So it's foundational, and it critically informs fascism and the far right, but Australian politics generally, it's inescapable.
Mm. Are there efforts even from the government now to try and make things at least a little better for these people?
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, you know, there's this term called closing the gap, which has been employed by governments for the last 20 years of, you know, both Labor and Coalition. And it's intended to recognise the kind of the gulf in health and education, all sorts of other incomes, outcomes between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, and closing the gap, so rendering it kind of, you know, less racist or less racist in its implications. It's failed. Last year, there was a referendum. This was basically, an attempt to change the Australian Constitution in order to allow for and have affixed to the Parliament a permanent body, an Indigenous advisory group. So having no legislative power, but if the referendum was successful, then it would be the case that written into the Australian Constitution would be the need for some kind of Indigenous body, which would need to be referred to and consulted with in regards to any kind of federal legislation. The referendum failed. It was considered to be one of the last kind of major legislative attempts to address this ongoing matter. On a state level, there's various forms of inquiries and commissions which are attempting to inaugurate some kind of, state-based treaty mechanism which recognises not only, the beginnings of colonisation, but the effects that are ongoing that are revealed through any number of, statistics that you care to apply, and also have the state recognise, and with the power of law, that there's no legitimate basis for robbing people of their lands. And insofar as there's any kind of recognition, people are entitled to compensation. So it's a long story of alienation, real and attempted genocide, and that kind of forms the basis and the foundation for Australian politics and society, and it's ongoing, and the struggles are ongoing as well. So the referendum failed, but there are many Indigenous peoples who are, of course, continuing to pursue struggles for their rights against the colonial state.
Mm. And in terms of the far-right groups, how do they address this? Are they of the opinion that it's good, we came in, we took the land, it doesn't matter, it's good that we did that, or do they kind of explain it away as if it was always their land or something? How does it work with them?
Pretty much the former. There was a battle, we won, bad luck. And in fact, there's a kind of real resentment expressed. This was conquest. This was legitimate, to acknowledge this history, to attempt to come to terms with it in any other way that doesn't celebrate it is considered suspicious and potentially treasonous. Beyond that, there are some elements within the broader history of the right which, insofar as they draw on notions of, like, for example, blood and soil and so on, they've got to try and reconcile the existence of cultures and peoples for tens of thousands of years in this part of the world, which on one level, on their basis, provides them legitimacy. At the same time, you have this, kind of British conquest. So there have been kind of very minor tendencies within Australian ultranationalist thought that have attempted to kind of reconcile these things and even, claimed that some Indigenous groups are Aryan. I mean, it's pretty crazy, but that's where their kind of ideology takes them. But for the most part, it's simply an assertion. There was a battle, we won. We're not going to apologise. In fact, this is part of, our destiny as part of, an expression of Western and white civilization in the Asia Pacific region. There's no apologies. If you look at the assemblies that have taken place, the public rallies, they've rejected the referendum, the voice, any claim by Indigenous peoples to this land. This is a white man's land.
Wow. It's so weird to me when you think, like, It's the very recent history of literally getting there on a boat. But anyway, I guess that's the way they think. In terms of the more militant contemporary far-right groups, who are we looking at these days? Who are the more active, more militant groups in Australia?
Probably the most well-known, almost certainly, is a group called the National Socialist Network. It's neo-Nazi, explicitly so. They identify Hitler as being a great inspiration. The leader of the group, Tom Sewell, once claimed that he had undergone some kind of electric shock as a result of which Hitler appeared to him and anointed him the leader within Australia. So we're dealing with some interesting characters. But his history goes back a few years to about 10 years ago when we had a thing called Reclaim Australia. And that was, this was 2014, 2015. It launched largely in response to the Cafe Lint siege. So there was a cafe in Sydney, Muslim took over that cafe for a brief period, made various statements, was eventually killed during the course of a police raid on that cafe. But it was read as being evidence that Muslims were being given too much license. It spurred into action a range of Islamophobic actors on the right who organised a series of rallies in 2015 called Reclaim Australia. So Australia was to be reclaimed from, you know, Muslims and the left and, you know, all the usual suspects. There was a series of rallies. During the course of those rallies, figures like Tom Sewell, the leader of the NSN, and various others emerged. They presented themselves then not as neo-Nazis but just as patriots, concerned about the future of the country, identifying...
Were they not called NSM back then? I was going to say that would be a bit of a giveaway. Yeah,
they formed another group called the United Patriots Front. So the thing about Reclaim Australia was there was a series of public rallies, essentially calling upon the government to rid Australia of Muslims. There were counter protests, and it was actually in response to these counter protests, which were reasonably successful in disrupting some of these Reclaim Australia protest rallies, that the UPF was formed, and it conceived itself as being a kind of political vanguard. It was going to protect the ordinary mums and dads of Reclaim Australia from the anti-fascists and the anti-racists and all these other people who emerged out of nowhere to confront, you know, Reclaim. So Tom Sewell was a key figure. There were others. It was a fairly small group. But I think what happened was from 2015 through until about 2017, Islamophobia was a real thing. It reached, you know, lots of people, especially through social media. On Facebook, the UPF had grew a following to something like 150 or 200,000 users, which was significant. It was also significant that in the case of Reclaim, previously far-right actors had been reluctant to put their faces forward and their names forward. Reclaim allowed them to do so they were quite open, you know, which I think was an important breakthrough. But also on social media, they were able to use social media quite effectively to reach a much wider audience and to present themselves as being, you know, ordinary mums and dads, not determined right-wing actors. So it all goes back to then. And since then, there's been a kind of period of experimentation. So Reclaim became the UPF. The UPF dissolved after Facebook pulled the plug on its Facebook page. Then they formed something called the Lad Society, which again presented itself as being fairly normie for young men who were interested in fitness and patriotism. They were invited to come to the physical spaces that the lads had acquired, so you could come to the gym, train, and also be fed, you know, mentally with books about race and immigration and so on. So there's been a kind of process of experimentation over the course of the last 10 years. And in my reading of it, the leading actors have been fairly determined right-wing actors. Whether or not they've chosen to, you know, announce that to the public depends. I think it's a strategic and tactical calculation. But over time, you know, we have the NSN now. They're quite prominent because they engage in lots of publicity stunts. There's a core of, I think it's largest presence is in Melbourne. There'd be many dozens of members, young, dedicated. They have another wing they call the European Australian Movement, which is meant to be have broader appeal, allow for participation by, you know, older guys who have partners and jobs and things to lose. That's a bit less explicit. But the NSN is very much about young guys going out there, flying the flag. and doing a lot of stunts, which means that the NSN has an international audience as well. So there's a lot of, as there always has been, nationalists do like to do international networking. So you'll have members of the NSN travel to North America or to Europe to take part in events, far-right events over there. There's an exchange of, you know, materials of propaganda. It's a global movement. The Australian expression of what's a global movement that's very much, you know, networked, cooperating in Australia. Just recently, like the Active Club model, which has been in existence for quite a few years, but as a kind of term, I guess, has been popularised recently. That's, you know, begun to have an effect. And so they're building. The one thing, they haven't quite reached the point where they're able to openly confront opposition. So if they're attacking or disrupting events, it's, you know, drag queen story time or something. It's fairly, you know, people in places where they don't expect to generate much militant opposition. They're opportunistic in that sense.
And how violent are these people? Are these people that are doing the training camps that you've seen with the so-called active clubs? What are they up to? How much of a threat are they in that sense?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, most notoriously, the NSN, when it was something previous called the Lad Society, attempted to recruit the Christchurch killer. So he was among, he was part of that movement, loosely engaged, exchanging messages. For example, in 2016, there was a fascist rally in the suburb of Coburg in the north of Melbourne, which has a relatively high population of Muslims. This was an anti-migration rally. The Christchurch killer online expressed support for the rally, you know, thought this was about taking the fight up to the enemy. So he was kind of inspired by the general anti-Muslim rhetoric. And, of course, in March 2019, he conducted a mass murder in Christchurch and justified it on the basis that this was, you know, him taking the kinds of very violent actions that were required that most people attracted to this movement, you know, choose not to. He was, and he was anointed. He's become one of the first in a succession of similar figures around the world who've undertaken spectacular and spectacularly violent action, partly on the basis of trying to inspire others to take these forms of action. So in that context, very concerning. You know, in terms of their own claims, they say, well, look, if you don't allow us, and I think this has been said quite explicitly on the part of the leader and various others, if you don't allow us to, you know, organise as the EAM or NSN, what are we meant to do? This is like, you know, there's a kind of veiled, I think, threat or implied threat that if you don't allow these groups to function publicly, if there's any form of reaction or opposition, it's going to radicalise them. They might take more, you know, violent steps. Beyond that, there's been, you know, a number of cases, prosecutions that have been brought against those who have been members of the NSN or in its orbit. They're alleged to have, you know, planned various actions, terrorist actions. Those cases are ongoing. Some have been convicted, some have not. So it's, you know, the kind of, if you take their rhetoric seriously, you know, what they're aiming for is to cleanse Australian society of various, you know, ethnic, cultural, religious elements. So if you take it seriously, the implications are quite violent. Their own activities have been, you know, confined. I mean, I think you could consider the fact that, for example, Antipodean Resistance formed in 2016 or thereabouts. It was attached to a broader network, a global network, which included other groups like National Action in the UK and, you know, Atom Boffin and various others. And these groups have been, or members of the groups have been, found guilty of various terrorist offences. So I'd say that, those kinds of elements are always present. The NSN paints itself as wanting to pursue a political road. But if you look at the actual, legal dimensions, the caseload that surrounds a number of the leading individuals and people on its periphery, violence is both embedded within the ideology and associated with a number of people who've kind of been attracted to it. It's concerning.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Antipodean Resistance. That's a group that was on my radar for quite a while when I was first looking into Atomwaffen Division in, I think, 2015, 2016. And it was, if I remember rightly, their very first kind of international friend or partner outside of National Action, which seemed weird considering Atomwaffen was in the US and usually it will be European or other US like neo-Nazi groups that would end up being like their pals. But Antipodean Resistance was very much on their radar. They were constantly posting, they were making all these stickers, and I think they got a lot of their kind of flyering sticker campaign ideas from them. Can you go into a little bit of detail about who they were? Because it kind of fell off my radar, and I know that when Atomwaffen started all getting locked up, there was no talk anymore of that group. They kind of vanished from their sphere. Who were they?
They formed via Iron March. So it was one of the groups associated with Iron March. I guess the good thing about, one of the few good things about Iron March is that it did get doxxed at one point and contents leaked. So if you want to, as far as Australia is concerned in particular, and that's my chief focus, you can actually identify several dozen of the Australian-based participants in Iron March, their establishment of Antipodean Resistance. It had a fairly short life between about 2016 and 2018. A leading figure was Jacob Hursant, who's now re-emerged as a leader within the NSN. But there are other figures associated with Antipodean Resistance who joined the NSN. So in some ways you can view the NSN as being a kind of successor organisation to Antipodean Resistance. And then you also have to consider that there's any number of, splinters. What kind of existence they have outside of, the online sphere can be difficult to say. And there's always, there's a classic book on Australian fascism called Everyone Wants to Be Führer, which was published, I think, in 1972, looking at an earlier generation of Nazi. But from the title, it suggests that there's a whole range of figures who are kind of battling one another for leadership or some kind of prominence within these movements. And that can be dangerous in the sense that, especially I think for younger members, and a number of them have been found themselves before the courts partly for this reason, there's a kind of pressure upon them to demonstrate their commitment to the cause through making various public statements or undertaking or claiming to want to undertake various public actions, which can be spectacular and violent. That's the kind of, that's where they're coming from. So being able to kind of discern, I guess, the more dangerous elements from the shit talkers is always difficult. But in terms of personnel, in terms of the ideology, Antipodean Resistance, continues to live through the NSN. And what I think has happened is the NSN has been relatively public. Like, it was just last weekend, there was an assembly of maybe 30 or 40 members in Melbourne who turned up, central Melbourne to Fed Square, to the major railway station, to the Immigration Museum, to parade around in public. And mostly that's for their own internal purposes. They film themselves, they put it online, and they reach young men. That's the whole kind of purpose. They're able to do that in flash mobs without announcing their presence. Any attempt by them to assemble publicly in a way that's kind of broadly known will bring about opposition, and they're less successful when they try and be really public. So they're limited. But the ideology, and anyone who's kind of looked into whether it's Iron March or Antipodean Resistance or the Order of Nine Angles, the kinds of discussions that are taking place online are truly, you know, disturbing. How much you can read into it in terms of, you know, that forming the basis for a likely course of action is, you know, difficult, but certainly the kind of material that's being engaged with and the people they're reaching out to, like young guys, teenagers, young guys in their 20s who have issues of one sort or another, let's say are vulnerable for one reason or another. You know, I do worry about the capacity of these groups to reach these individuals with certain messages that, you know, is likely to generate really awful outcomes. So it's certainly a matter of concern.
Yeah, and I think the thing with the NSN is their visuals are very much like old school National Action, all black. You know, there's a lot of them as well, big lads, they're training. It looks like they're trying to create this community. And certainly, I think a lot of young men are looking for that. I imagine in Australia as much as anywhere else. I think that's probably one of their biggest draws, as well as obviously all the awful fascist politics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it gives young guys a sense of identity, a sense of purpose, camaraderie. You know, it has appeal. And, you know, I think that the problem is, or one of the issues that needs to be kind of dealt with is, you know, very often they're reaching individuals who have legitimate grievances for one reason or another. They're not being reached by others who might be able to steer them in a more, you know, positive, healthy direction. That's not happening. But they're also under, you know, pressure. You know, one of the kind of main sources of information that I have is, you know, family and friends of some of the young individuals involved who are, you know, they're not, they look with concern at what's happening and they throw their hands up about what it is that they can do in order to ensure that these young guys who are being preyed upon, you know, these guys are being groomed, they're being preyed upon. You know, it's a kind of more general phenomenon of people who are vulnerable. So it's about identifying or recognizing that these people are being preyed upon and trying to steer people in a, you know, a better direction, because there's lots of reasons to be angry and upset. The kinds of solutions that are being offered by these groups are, you know, false solutions. And that's how, you know, that's part of the battle. But they often, you know, it's about, you know, appealing to their grievances, having this fantasy of themselves as being, you know, dominant figures. Life may not be turning out that way. And offering them some kind of false security, false, you know, solution.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at NSN, even any of their pictures, they're very clearly training for something, or at least they think they are, whether they're going to do it or not. What is it that they think they're going to do? Do they have, like, a very explicit end goal? I know they're trying to maybe be a little bit more, you know, on the side of the law or whatever, but if you just look at any of their kind of propaganda, very clearly they're not talking about it like that behind closed doors.
Yeah, I mean, this is a neo-Nazi group. So, and they're reasonably explicit about that. And I think one of the things, if you examine the career trajectories of people like Sewell and others, they've come to the point where they understand that there's this, they think or they believe that there's sufficient support among the broader community to sustain a neo-Nazi project. So they no longer need to pretend that that's, you know, that they're anything than what they are. And what they're about is they're drawing on their experience of the last 10 years. And I think from my perspective, I think it's important to recognize that these guys are, however abhorrent their ideology, however unappealing, you know, their political vision might be, they're rational political actors, right? And they've gotten to the point where it can become possible with sufficient support to really, lay down roots to create white communities as they conceive of them, for that to be, for there it not to be such a penalty, a social penalty, to be identified publicly as a neo-Nazi. So I think that they've been relatively successful. They're beginning to hit some difficulties in terms of their public presence, because they are openly neo-Nazi. Their appeal is limited. But if they're able to appear at, as they did a month or two ago at the Polish Club, the Polish Club is a local ethnic association for Polish Australians to discuss all manner of things. The NSN were present at a meeting that was organised in order to discuss the question of immigration. They didn't organise the rally. They weren't the primary speakers, but they were present and they were accepted as being a legitimate presence, which seems somewhat incongruous given this is a Polish club, a migrant club. They're talking about the problems to do with
the irony.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not the first time. It's not novel. And so, these guys are going to take whatever opportunities they can. They've tried to profit from COVID, from lockdown, in Melbourne in particular, it was subject to quite draconian forms of lockdown, which generated, a range of resentments on a broader scale. People were asking, why are we being locked down? These groups, to the extent that they're, and I think that they are rational, they'll look at the political landscape and think, where can we intervene? How do we create a fascist cadre? Which is essentially what they're doing, which is what, these physical spaces that they're creating to engage in training, physical training, ideological training. To me, I think it's, a number of them have military backgrounds, a number of them are gym bros. This is like rational activity. So I kind of look at it in terms of, from an anti-fascist perspective, how do you kind of monitor, understand what's going on, try and disrupt their effects, but offer, healthier alternatives to given everything else that's going on in the world. There's going to be a lot more angry young people. How do you kind of relate to that anger and steer it in a way that's not blaming, the Jews or some other group? So, it's an ongoing process. They've had some success, and I wouldn't underestimate their potential. And that they also have enough nous to, in Australia there's been the introduction of various laws against, say, the public display of the swastika. Most of them have enough nous not to, not to break that law. They don't need to. They use other symbols. To me, this capacity of theirs to think about legal and political consequences and to navigate them with a view to building their group, of establishing an international audience, of, deploying, Give, Send, Go, the Christian Nationalist fundraiser, in order to raise funds, to portray themselves as defenders of Western civilization. You've got to give them some kind of credit for being rational political actors. And I think the ones that are actually the more dangerous. The ones who are lunatic are the ones you can easily dismiss. The ones that are rational are the ones you really got to pay attention to.
Would you say they're on the rise?
The NSN?
Yeah. Like, I read some, security analysts from Australia saying that, they're very serious on the rise, But, I think, no disrespect to any of those writers, but I think it's often in the best interest of security analysts to say that regarding almost anything. What do you think?
Well, I think they're kind of in a period in which they're conducting political experiments. And this is how I view the last 10 years. You've got determined right-wing actors who are looking at what's going on and asking themselves, how can we intervene that has an effect and builds our own forces? And we've got to be careful about that. So they're making rational political calculations. And at some point, Sewell in particular has decided, I no longer have to, disguise my power level or whatever terminology is being used. I no longer have to disguise the fact that actually I'm a Nazi. I appreciate Hitler and so on and so forth. And that's a moment of decision. You know, it's like, okay, can I do this or not? I think the jury's still out. I think what's going on is they're hoping that there's been this kind of broader expansion, which means that an explicitly neo-Nazi political project can sustain itself over time. And I think that's where we're at. So the other thing is, like, a group like the NSN, I frequently see people dismiss them for one reason or other. They're a bunch of young kids, they're incels, they're this, they're that. Actually, if you look at the membership, there are young members, teens, 20s, but there are also guys in their 30s and 40s who have partners, who have children, who have jobs, who have a future, who have something to lose. And the question is, are there enough of them that can form a network, which means that previously if you were exposed as a Nazi, that had serious political and social repercussions. You would be sent to Coventry, right? You'd no longer be considered part of the broader community. I think what's happening is they're asking through their political experimentation, and a lot of it's media-driven. There's a huge global audience for these guys. You know, lots of people, there's probably more support outside of Australia than within it for these kinds of guys. And it's partly because they're open and unabashed. They're like, yeah, you know, we worship Hitler, fuck you, what are you going to do about it? You know, we can sustain a project even on that basis. And in terms of the political imaginary of the far right globally, Australia has long been understood as being kind of one of the last reservations, let's call it, for whiteness, for white nationalism. It's been one of the last, you know, you can read it on Stormfront, all sorts of other forums, and it's partly because of its history of the embrace of the White Australia policy. It's kind of like a last resort. And I think that what Sewell and others are doing is they're planting the flag. They're saying, yes, we're unabashed, and we can sustain ourselves. So the question is at the moment, can they sustain themselves or will they implode? And it's unclear to me, you know, in which direction they'll go.
Just talking there about like Australia being this kind of like, you know, white reservation, does the geographical situation come into that? And I mean that as in, like, you just have so much open space, right? Like, it would be quite easy for like 50 Nazis to go off into somewhere and train completely unwatched, whereas that's just very rarely going to happen. Like in England, I mean, you know, you can't move for houses on top of houses, surveillance. I feel like Australia is probably like a lot easier to do that kind of stuff, just purely based on the terrain and openness.
There's an extent to which that's true. But, I mean, also you've got to understand, like, Australia is one of the most urbanised societies in the world. So the vast majority of the people living in Australia live in urban spaces. So it's kind of like, you know, maybe 10% of the population lives outside of the major urban centres, which kind of, you know, feeds into this idea of, you know, a big emptiness or something like that. It's not quite true. But certainly in at least the imagination, it's like it's still kind of considered some kind of frontier, despite the fact that it's, you know, home to some of the oldest living cultures on Earth, you know, going back tens of thousands of years. So there's that kind of, you know, it's radically false that the place is, you know, unoccupied or, you know, there are long cultural traditions. It's more about, it's a reflective of, you know, European imperialism, basically. But certainly within the white imaginary, that's certainly how it's perceived. And as being one of the more successful kind of colonial settler projects, you know, maybe 2 to 5% of the population identify as Indigenous. It's the population of Australia is overwhelmingly non-Indigenous, overwhelmingly white, and remains the case. So there's a kind of, you know, battle in reality and in the imagination about what Australia, the space that Australia occupies. I think the principal complaint from, you know, American white supremacists is, you know, gun control laws. They're much stricter over here. You can't just go and form a militia. You know, you get into big trouble.
But there is a lot of space where they could go and train otherwise, though, right?
Sure, sure. But, you know, on the one hand, yeah, there's theoretically plenty of space, but most people are living in the cities, and that's where, you know, the bulk of the white population is too.
Right, right. That makes sense. Yeah, it's just like in England that, you know, we have like fascist groups will go up into like the mountains of Yorkshire and train, but then like 15 ramblers we'll see them. You know what I mean? It's like we don't have a lot of space. I just thought maybe there's more of it there, but that is something I didn't know. Like everybody basically just living in the cities. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. In terms of international ties, what do the NSN and any other groups, are they trying to cultivate these international ties? I noticed that's happening. It's always been happening, but just from my own research, I've seen almost a resurgence of that happening recently. What about in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can remember back in the even 90s, there was a lot of international exchange on the fascist and anti-fascist side of things. So there are all kinds of communications taking place between anti-fascists in Australia and elsewhere in the world about what was going on here and what was going on elsewhere. Like I think, you know, post-internet, there's a sense in which you can be anywhere in the world and have an effect. And certainly with the NSN and other groups, and this is not new, there's real effort, and it makes sense for nationalists to work across, you know, national boundaries and intensively. And I think it's one of the things that actually fascists, you know, Nazis outside of Australia really thrilled to in the NSN is its capacity to, you know, conduct these stunts, to produce material that's shared online across the world, to give kind of, you know, inspiration to those everywhere. And you know, the NSN, other groups, they're part of that. Also the personnel, there is a certain degree of exchange, like we've talked about Antipodean resistance, but also NSN. You know, individual members have travelled to Europe, to the UK, to take part in face-to-face meetings, to take part in public assemblies, and gain a real thrill from that, as they should. I mean, the internationalist dimension of the nationalist movement is, you know, well developed and always has been. And I think there's a general understanding that for them, you know, comrades in Melbourne draw inspiration from comrades in Munich or wherever, and it's, there's nothing really, it makes sense, you know. Of course they will. And of course they'll cultivate those links and support one another. And that's always been the case. And that will continue.
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, this is a bit of an odd one, but I just wanted to ask about the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, the SSNP, fascist pro-Assad militia. Now, I'm sure you're aware, but anyone that doesn't know, there was a, from what I understand, a children's SSNP sort of training camp type thing happened in Australia a few years ago. Do you know much about that?
I don't know much about the training camp, no.
Yeah, there was these photos came out, and it was like a diaspora group had like basically brought their kids into the SSNP, and there was apparently quite a small but like very kind of active, you know, SSNP support group in Australia. I don't know. Do they have much roots there? I have read like a few articles saying that, you know, it's strange that they do have this kind of support in Australia.
I'm sure they do. I mean, I associate it with something called the Sydney Forum, which was a gathering in Sydney, principally organised by the Australia First Party, at which the SSNP was invited, at which speakers appeared. You know, I guess insofar as Australia is a multicultural society, you'll find Syrians, you'll find all sorts of communities that have nationalist aspirations and political aspirations, which mean that they sometimes form common ground or discover common ground with a whole range of other, you know, nationalist groups, including Australian. So beyond that, I'd say there's a kind of red-brown dimension, let's call it, national socialism, social nationalism. I mean, however you want to kind of approach those ideologies and those distinctions, there's a form of ultranationalism which accompanies any kind of national community. That's especially the case with Australia, where you continue to have strong support for, say, the Ustasha among the Croatian community in Australia. It's not surprising. I guess what's interesting is to look at the ways in which these ultranationalist groups form alliances with other ultranationalists or not, according to the time and the place. So the SSNP, yeah, has a presence. It's fairly minor, but they find allied groups and sometimes they work together. The same applies to, let's say, Golden Dawn. Golden Dawn had a presence among the Greek diaspora in Australia. It was minor. It didn't generate a great deal of support, but it was real. And it's not that surprising given the size of the Greek diaspora in Australia. It's large. And so you'll find, you know, Greek fascists, Greek communists. You'll find Syrian fascists, Syrian anti-fascists. How it all plays out across those contradictions and tensions is an interesting question. But they're all present and, you know, among many communities.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I know there was even, like, links between, like, the base and some people in Australia. I know there wasn't many of them, but you guys had, like, members of the base, right, that neo-accelerationist fascist group that was based in America. The leader now lives in Russia. Like, very weird connections.
Yeah, all that stuff takes place. And I guess, you know, it can take a bit of time and energy to kind of work out, from an outsider's perspective, what's going on? Are these relations real? Are they temporary? What's their basis? But it's the internet, man. You get all kinds of people being brought together for all different kinds of reasons, and where they go, you can't quite necessarily anticipate, but yeah, it's remarkable, and those links are real, and it's really, you know, they're just a click away, really.
Yeah. Before we go, maybe you want to talk a little bit about your work. I was particularly impressed with some anti-fascist groups in Australia, just in terms of how kind of well-organized they were. I used to be friends with some guys in, what is it, WSC, 161 WSC. They were pretty cool. And, yeah, so I know a little bit about, like, the anti-fascist scene there. But, yeah, maybe you want to talk a little bit about your work.
Sure. I've been blogging as Slack Bastard for about 20 years or so. At the time, 20 years ago, there was another mob called Fight Them Back, which had formed. It was an online group. It had actually formed in response to an alliance between fascists in Australia and Aotearoa, New Zealand. So it was kind of a response to that. I became involved in that group and began to write some things. I had a long-standing interest in, you know, the political right. And since then, I guess, one of the reasons I guess I've felt compelled to continue to maintain some kind of online presence is because I thought the issues were important, somewhat unacknowledged, and a lot of the writing around it occurred to me, tended to be uninformed, like from a journalistic perspective. There were very few people who had, you know, it was not assigned as being a kind of beat or whatever. So a lot of the kind of reportage was episodic, didn't really come to terms with the history and so on. So I kind of developed the blog as a way of commenting on that sort of thing. And because to some extent, because no one else was doing it, it assumed a kind of importance, which eventually, as these groups, especially 2014, 2015, as they began to assume a more public presence, more people began to pay attention, other people became organised. So you'll have, you know, anti-fascist groups forming across Australia in response to Reclaim or the UPF or this or that or the other. It's somewhat neglected in the last few years, and especially post-Christchurch. Like, I think the mass murder, the atrocity that the Christchurch killer committed in March of 2019 had a real impact in terms of kind of underscoring, you know, why it might be an idea to pay attention to these sorts of ideas and movements because of the deadly consequences that come from allowing them to develop unchecked. That was a dramatic, vivid illustration. That was 2019, it's 5 years later. The state has acknowledged the dangers associated with these ideas and movements. There's been some recognition within academia as well, but the record's been kind of patchy, so I continue to, you know, comment publicly to encourage groups like the White Rose Society. I'd recommend people look at it's a anonymous anti-fascist research group that looks at all these groups and examines them in some detail and brings to the public's attention facts about them that I think help to disrupt their activities. So that's been the blog. That's what I've been doing. Part of the struggle has been just really to try and encourage people to take these things seriously, and to suggest that fascism and the far right, they're not just historical phenomena. They have a place within broader history, but Australian history in particular. We need to pay attention to them. We need to pay attention to them in order to disrupt them, to dismantle them, and to create the space in which more healthy political alternatives can develop. So that's been what's kind of animated my own work. And, you know, I'll continue to do it while there's a need. And that doesn't seem to be subsiding anytime soon.
No, unfortunately not, actually. It's why we kind of made this series. If people want to get in touch with you, mate, and look at your work, which I definitely recommend they do, where's the best place that they can do that?
The best place is probably the blog, which is slackbastard.anarchobase.com. In terms of communication, I have a Proton Mail account. I encourage people to use that for, you know, encrypted communications, slackbastard@protonmail.com. I also do a radio show on community radio, 3CR, with my comrade Cam Smith every week. We've been going about 5 years, flying the flag of anti-fascism. So please listen to the show, and otherwise, you know, generally pay attention.
Excellent. Thank you, mate. We'll put all the links in the description so people can get to that easier.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thanks, Jack.
Cheers, mate. Appreciate that. That was Skeleton Key, a popular front project focused on contemporary far-right militant groups. Music by Sam Black. Sound mix by Splicing Block. If you pirated this episode, all right, but please consider supporting at patreon.com/popularfront. We are entirely independent, grassroots conflict journalism. No one owns us. No one has a single share. We do not take money from bastards.